Welcome to Home Space and Reason, a podcast about creating a home that thrives.
Hi there, I'm Christina Browning, your host. If you know your home could be so much more than it is, I discuss home functionality, aesthetics, and automation. I'm a realtor in Portland, Oregon, and a home functionality coach. I geek out on every subject imaginable regarding your home and yard, challenging you to think of your space differently to get the most out of every square foot. I pose questions for you to think through about your space and your reason. This podcast is all positive, offering you virtual fist bumps and celebrating every win. Remember, there's no such thing as perfect, but you can still aim for your best every day. Join me on social media by searching for the handle Space and Reason. In this episode, let's discuss mental health, furniture reupholstering, and sustainability. I know what you're thinking. How can those three things possibly go together in one episode? Courtney Winstone of the Salvaged Wood Shop lives in the UK, southeast of London, near Winchester. She's an upholsterer and furniture upcycler. I struggled with the title of this episode because the wonderful story of Courtney's life is just as real and rich as the parts that relate to home interiors and the furniture she creates. I was smitten when I came across the salvagedwoodshop.com and immediately reached out to her in hopes we could do this episode together. Her website About Me page is so personal and beautiful. By the time I was at the bottom, I felt like I had sat down for tea with her. The photos, the writing, she absolutely nailed it all.
I had been living in London, up until about 12 years ago, but coming from Saskatchewan, I needed a bit more space. It was rather enclosed, shall we say. I don't know, have you ever been to London?
I have not.
It's very tight. The houses literally are attached to each other, which from us both coming from North America is completely different. So yeah, you've got neighbors attached on both sides. So I needed some space. So we got out and we live in the countryside and it's very green, lots of trees. So it's Hampshire, if anybody's listening from the UK. And it's near just north of Winchester and near, it's a lovely little town called Alresford. We're very lucky.
Wonderful. I wanted to start with your backstory. Tell me about your grandpa's woodworking shop.
So actually, both my grandfathers were woodworkers. One did more, you know, like the Muskoka chairs.
Side note, I had not heard of the term Muskoka. And after the interview was over, I looked it up and saw in front of me what I call an Adirondack chair. However, when I looked up what is the difference between a Muskoka chair and an Adirondack chair, I learned a Muskoka has a curved yoke while the Adirondack is flat. The Adirondack is more of a reclined scenario. It's extremely comfortable, which makes it perfect for lounging. However, the Muskoka can be easier to get out of, making it more suitable for seniors. Look, it was just 1 minute into the interview and we learned something new about furniture already. I was delighted. Okay, back to the interview where we were talking about her grandfather.
Have you ever heard of a Muskoka chair? If you're Canadian, you probably have. They might have a different name for them in the US. He was more sort of building structures. And then my other grandpa, he did intarsia and he did finer things. So he would make jewelry boxes out of wood and he was more into the detail.
And there's another term I wasn't familiar with. What is intarsia? I wondered the same thing. Intarsia is an early Italian art form of wood inlay. The term is specifically applied to a type of inlaying probably developed in Siena, Italy in the 13th century and derived from Middle Eastern inlays of ivory upon wood. Today, intarsia is created by selecting different types of wood using its natural grain patterns and colors to create the different colors in the pattern. Each piece of wood is then individually cut, shaped, and sanded before fitting them together like a jigsaw puzzle and gluing them to a piece of quarter-inch plywood backing that is cut to the shape of the final product. Sometimes additional pieces of plywood are used to raise areas of the pattern to create more depth. Once together, a final layer of finish is applied and the project is complete. Over the years, it has evolved into a more sculptural style of wood-crafted art. Each intarsia artist has his or her own technique and approach to the art. I had no idea.
So they each had a woodworking shop, but I'm very lucky where I grew up in Saskatchewan, we have lots of space. And my dad was able to get his dad's woodworking shop moved onto our farm. So when I go back to see my parents, I can go into the shop and yeah, it just brings back loads of memories.
So did he actually let you like do stuff in there with him when you were young?
Yeah. So sometimes, sometimes not. When I started doing my industrial arts in high school, which was kind of grade 10, 11, 12, I'd go in and just use the shop whenever I wanted. He didn't care because he knew I was capable of using all the machinery, all the tools. But when I was younger, maybe, yeah, a little bit, I guess. You know, he, as I say in my bio, I'd hammer anything he would give me, sort of thing. He would just give me, you know, if something needed varnishing, then he'd let me varnish and teach me how to do it. So I was quite young when I started doing little bits for him, actually.
So tell me about your industrial arts in high school / transition to living in the Philippines.
You know, we had a whole setup in the school, and I ended up working on the lathe and doing woodworking, architectural drawing over 3 years, basically. So we didn't get a huge amount of time to do it, but you know, it was at least an hour, if not 2 hours a week, if I recall correctly. And I probably should have gone into woodworking after high school, but I didn't. I ended up doing business marketing instead, just at a tech college called SIAST in a town called Moose Jaw. They were doing an exchange program between Asia. And I think 10 people went over to Asia and 10 people came from Asia. I applied for a business marketing, 6 months to go over somewhere in Asia. I didn't know where. You just had to write a letter. And I got it. The letter came through and I was really excited. So I phoned my mom and I said, guess what? I'm going to the Philippines. And she said, where's that? And I went, I don't know. I had never even heard of the Philippines before. So I started in Quezon City, which used to be, that's where the 6 month work placement was. And that used to be the capital. The capital is now Manila. So I was there for about 3 months and I was working for Simeo Innotech, which was Southeast Asian Ministers of Education. So three people above me in the company was basically the education minister of the Philippines. And she took a little bit of a shine to me. She took me all over the country for 6 months, meeting all the barangays, meeting all the local mayors, and basically going to see what they were doing in terms of educating their populace. I had my own flat just beside the University of the Philippines, I think it was called. I was the only white person within a very large radius because the central business district is in Makati is in Manila, which is nowhere near Quezon City. So I was living like a local.
Wow.
So properly submersed into the culture. I was learning the language and it was an amazing time in my life. And I didn't want to leave. I really didn't want to leave. The Philippines is very Americanized and has been for a very long time. The actual building itself was a new build because a lot of the places around me were like slums put together with things that they had found from the garbage dump, corrugated metal and roofs and that sort of stuff. It was a new concrete house, basically, with three levels. It was quite small. It had one bedroom upstairs and one bedroom downstairs, a little kitchenette area, and then a spiral staircase that went up. Not very high, but then when you came up the spiral staircase, there was a bit of a landing before you got into the bedroom. They had tried to make it look funky. There was one blue wall, and I think the doors to the closets were yellow or something like that. It was really bright, slightly primary colors, but it was fun. And then underneath there was a shop on one side and a hairdresser's on the other. And I actually ended up making friends with the hairdressers and being a model for them in Hair Asia.
Hilarious. How fun is that?
Yeah, it was so much fun. I was living. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to fast forward. You're back in London.
So I did huge conferences around the UK, some of them. So a lot of it was on site and actually at the conferences. I was sat at a desk until 4 a.m. in the morning in the run-up to the event and getting a taxi home and coming back at 7 a.m. to start the day again because I had so much to do.
Tell me when you had your first child, how things changed for you.
I had stopped working, so I definitely wasn't going to go back to that with a newborn. Having the girls 21 months apart, it was quite quick. So I hadn't really gotten my head around. I hadn't even thought about going back to work. Thankfully, I didn't have to. My husband was able to support us. So when my second child was 4 months old is when I had a bit of a breakdown. Thankfully, my husband was working from home that day. And I just remember going up into the loft where he was working and going, I can't do this anymore. And he went, thank God, because he had just seen me go down and then witness the crash, basically. But at that time, I couldn't hear that anything was wrong from anyone else. So I needed the crash in order to go, right, a lot has got to change.
You said, I had been a functioning depressive who lived for the highs and got very angry when things didn't go my way or when I couldn't control a situation. So just reading that, I feel like I want to take a big breath for you.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of people did back then as well. Like, calm down.
But also, I think every mother can identify with that at some level.
Completely. And probably even if you're not a mother, because now having come through it, I look back at people and I see myself in them, how controlling they are being, how I used to be. And I see it absolutely everywhere.
So let's unpack that just a bit, because when some people say you're controlling, that could mean you're trying to control other people. But there's also a piece of that that is, I just want to have control over my life so I feel like I can relax, so I don't feel like I'm out of control. So on the spectrum of control, there's out of control and in control. And when you hear it that way, that's not bad.
Well, I guess it depends on your approach to I'm in control, because I thought I was in control. I did everything in my power so that everything was exactly the way I thought it should be. And yet I now know we are not in control of anything. Absolutely nothing. You can come at that control from a really stressful place. I'm not saying we can't influence anything. I'm very much about how could the universe help me in this situation? What could I show the universe what I want? Maybe not in the way that I expect it to be, but how can it give me what I'm looking for?
So steering and hoping for clarity as opposed to micromanaging.
Yeah, definitely no micromanaging. I actually use a lot of mantra in my life. So if I have a situation where I want it to change, I will often figure out what I would like it to look like. And then I use my words out loud and I say a statement like I'm actually living that truth already. I have a question that I keep asking myself. And this is because I'm making some choices that aren't good for me. I'm realizing this. The question is, will this choice free me or hinder me? I'm not yet at the stage where I'm actually asking myself the question before I go and do the thing that I know is going to hinder me. Does that make sense?
It makes wonderful sense. And the thing that's so beautiful about this is in every episode, I pose questions for you to think through. Ooh. And so I think it's totally beautiful that you subscribe to this personally about asking yourself questions in order to guide yourself in a very healthy way. So if you've listened to this podcast before, you know that sound means to grab a pen and paper because it's time for the questions to ask yourself about your space and your reasons. But today, in honor of Courtney and her journey, I would love for you to write down the question she poses because I think it can hold immense value for all of us. Will this choice free me or hinder me? Will this choice free me or hinder me?
Yeah, so I think I'm getting to the point where I'll do the thing that I don't want to do anymore. And I'm hearing that negative talk. God, I did it again. Why am I being so stupid? Why am I not asking myself that question? Will this choice free me or hinder me? I guess the difference now versus the difference when I had my break, or even for quite a few years after I had my break, was that I'm now aware of what I'm doing in almost every stage. And I'm also open to hearing what other people have to say. Let's take my husband, for instance. If he says, have you thought of maybe something that isn't serving you? I'll take that on board and I will have a think about that particular situation and whether it is serving me or not.
I call that marinating.
Oh, nice. I like that.
I'm going to let that marinate.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I'm in that cycle of doing the habit that I know I don't want to do anymore, but not quite at the tipping point where I am asking that question before I do the habit. And that can take a really long time to get to that stage where even just you're asking yourself the question. You might still ask yourself the question and still do the bad habit. And that stage can take a long time as well. I had a conversation with a Buddhist, and her name was Annie Zamba. And we had a beautiful evening, just sat on the floor with her on a couch, and she was talking to us and we were asking questions. And she said, look at it like a wave coming onto a beach. Waves will never cease. There will always be a wave. There will always be a crash. But you have the opportunity to be way out to sea and those waves just be crashing over you, and you have no idea when they're going to hit, how hard they're going to hit. When you become more aware, you kind of start to creep up the wave as it's crashing. So you see then when it crashes and you see how big it is, but it still crashes and it will always still crash. And being okay that it will crash is kind of bringing yourself to a greater awareness, basically. We need to make those bad choices in order to know that we don't want it anymore, in order for that we can then start to make changes in our lives to make different choices.
That's beautiful. You say, I began by giving myself permission and time to make mistakes, something I had never allowed myself to do, as this was not conducive to being a very organized, controlling perfectionist. I couldn't fathom selling anything because it's not good enough, or why would anyone purchase from me? I just wasn't there yet. I can see how someone who pushes themselves for perfection wouldn't feel comfortable selling something because you would naturally see every imperfection.
That's all I ever saw. That's often what I see now. Yeah, I started selling clothing. It was a French brand. They only sold it through kind of at-home visits. So you'd pick the clothes up and go to someone's house and show them, and then they'd place orders. And so it was good. And it was really easy to obviously fit around the girls. I did that for 3 years and then got really fed up.
So tell me about the point when you had a shift in your mind.
I was actually with my healer at the time, and we were having a conversation. I was saying, I'm really unhappy. I don't like what I'm doing. I want to do something. I want to give back to the world. My kids were probably about 6 and 4 at this point. So they were at school during the day. I had time. We were talking about me, that I always loved working with my hands. I'm always doing something with my hands. I did a lot of baking. My youngest had quite a few gut health issues. All she could eat was meat and veg for a very long time. So I had to learn to bake grain-free, sugar-free. It was an interesting time, a lot. But I loved it because I was doing something and I was creating something. It came back to working with my hands. We were sat in my living room and she looked out and she went, well, what about that shed in the bottom of your garden? Why couldn't you use that? For what we hadn't spoken about that yet. But I was like, that to me was the moment, was like, I've got a space. I can get all of the crappy garden furniture and stuff that's on the shelves in there out and use that as my own space. So that's what I did. I created a pallet shed. So my husband is quite good on a digger. So he dug a flat space and we used pallets on the floor, pallets on the walls. And then we got a guy to come in and cut a sloped roof so that all of the garden paraphernalia that we had in the building that had water to it could come out of there and go into the pallet shed. I just started painting and stripping back and sanding and allowed myself to make a lot of mistakes for almost 2 years. Didn't sell a thing.
So you started with a bookshelf.
I think it was a wardrobe, actually. It was my daughter's wardrobe.
Wardrobe.
Yeah. I did a bookshelf shortly after that. I did a 1960s, 70s telephone box at some stage. And then I kept seeing chairs that no one could sit on because they were, you know, the bottom was falling out of it, and thinking, I really want to get my hands on the wood. Often it's ash wood, any of the bent arms. And when you strip back that really black or dark brown stain that a lot of furniture has on it, underneath is a really lovely white ash wood. But I didn't know how to upholster them. It was kind of out of the corner of my eye. I think it was maybe on one of those ads that you see on the side of Facebook or something like that. And I saw it for community college upholstery courses. And I started that in 2018 and properly got hooked.
So tell me, you had a pop-up shop. Was that before or after COVID?
2 pop-up shops before COVID. Well, our lockdowns were slightly different here than they were in the US, but I had a third one just as we were coming out of lockdown. But after that first one, I was literally blown away by people coming in because I love color so much. I will put colors together that most people will not put together. Clearly, people saw what they saw in the front window and liked it and came in. We had a lot of passing trade. One of my chairs in my second pop-up shop sold before I'd even opened. I was literally just getting the stuff in the day before. And the lady came by and went, I want that chair. And I went, oh, I'm not quite open. When are you open? I'll come back. I was just like, okay, sure, it's yours.
Did you believe you were worthy after your first pop-up shop?
Not 100%. To go from not believing you were worthy at all, that it was a pretty short space of time between then and that first pop-up shop.
So when that woman said that, I want that, that chair is beautiful, I will even come back, you believed her.
I did. Yes, I did.
And you still thought it's a fluke? Tell me how do you square that up? Because you made that beautiful.
Yeah, I know.
To where it moved her to buy it.
So it's still listening to you. It's I can still feel in myself that I'm still not 100% there. I think one day I will be.
Do you believe that you're gifted in touching and renovating and bringing back to life pieces of furniture?
Yes, I can now say that yes, I do believe that. You know, when I see another upholsterer and I go, oh God, I never say I could never do that, but I look at them and in awe. But what I try and remind myself is that I'm not them. You know, I do things differently to them. And I try and tell myself on very regular occasions that I'll do me and I'll do me really well. And people who love that other person may not love me, but people who love me may not love that other person.
100%. You do you.
Definitely.
The best version of you. So your Master Upholsterer's course, when do you finish?
So June 2025. And then I might do another year after that.
You'll be a master upholsterer at that point, yes?
I don't know if that's the title you get, but I'll have done the master upholsterer course, yes.
What is your favorite type of furniture to work on?
Good question. I love a chair. And I quite like a chair where I get to strip back the wood and see what's underneath. Whatever disgusting brown thing they've put over the top of it, or whatever mold has deformed it. So I think year four, one of the potential course that I might do for an additional year is creating a chair from scratch. So literally from conception, doing all the frame and upholstering it.
Wow.
I can't wait to get there.
That's so exciting. We haven't really touched yet on your desire to take what other people throw away and like reform it and to not pollute the planet. So upcycling, tell me a little bit about where your passion for that started and then how it absolutely plays into what you do now.
Oh, completely. So I think I'm a slight hoarder. Although I am getting much better at, if I know I'm not going to use it, or if it's sat on the shelf for a year, I'm able to go, okay, this can now leave me. I'll find a new home for it. I think it started in earnest. So I really like tidy surfaces in my home. I'd got to the stage where the drawers were not closing properly. There was so much stuff in them. Clothing drawers, you know, knickknack drawers, crafting drawers. And I just ended up doing a massive blitz of the entire house. A lot of the stuff that I was coming across, I hadn't bought. So people had bought for us and it was unwanted. So I sent out a massive email. I wrote this huge email and I sent it out to my family and all of our close friends. And I basically said, we love you so much, but what we're going to spend a year doing is not buying anything we don't absolutely need. And I put this list of criteria together. So if we do need something, we're going to first ask, do we really need this or do we just want it? And then after the case, okay, so then we need it. Well, is there somewhere, someone, a family member or neighbor where we might be able to borrow it? Or could we find it on Facebook Marketplace or on eBay? And then once that was exhausted, if we couldn't find it there, then we would look at, you know, secondhand shops, charity shops. And if we really, really, really couldn't find it by then, or if we didn't already have something in our house that could suffice in its place, then we would go and buy it. But I actually think we didn't buy anything that entire year.
And to be clear for listeners, this was not a financial decision.
This was not a financial decision. No. This was a, I am so sick of stuff and stuff that we're holding on to that we just don't need.
So your email said, please don't give us anything?
So our email said, please don't give us anything. Don't spend money on cards. What we would really love is your time. So instead of buying us a birthday present or a Christmas present or sending a Christmas card and the air miles and the postage, because obviously I've got lots of family and friends in Canada, please, when I come home, can we put a date in the diary and spend some time together? It's free. And we would love that way more than receiving. Or pick up the phone and have a conversation with us. You know, have a video call. We basically asked for them to gift their time instead of money.
And how was it received?
Well, I didn't have a lot of people come back to me. But the ones that did, they were like, oh my God, I so want to do this. Because I had also told them about the blitz that I'd had in the house. Everybody was on board. There wasn't one person that went, I can't believe you're making us do this. We weren't really asking much of them.
Yeah, you were asking them not to. Please don't.
Yeah, I was asking them not to. Yeah.
So I had a sneaking suspicion that there are so many people out there that would like to send an email to their family and friends just like that. And Courtney so graciously agreed to share her letter with us. And so I have created a blog post from that, and I will link to it in the show notes so you can refer to that for inspiration in writing your own letter to your family and friends to help create a more sustainable lifestyle. Do you actively go to, I don't know, I don't want to say the dump. I don't know what you all call it there.
The tip. The tip.
Where do you find things to prevent them from going to the landfill?
So the tip is a very good source. Hampshire has like shops at their tip. So when you go to dump something, if it's saleable, you can put it into their shop free of charge for you, and they'll just sell it on.
I feel like this is genius. I don't know why, at least where I live in Portland, Oregon, we do not have any shops that you can buy anything at the dump. But this is such a wonderful idea. I feel like I want to tag every single county in the United States, because this is such an easy turnkey way. People show up there with things that are perfectly good. They may not even want to put it in the landfill, but for whatever reason, can't find another home for it and are now at the dump with it. But yet someone else could absolutely use it.
But it's a really good place, especially after, well, I shouldn't say this maybe, but especially after long weekends, the shop is often very full. There are loads of charity shops and lots of furniture charity shops. And actually on my website, if you live in the Hampshire area, I mean, even if you live in the UK, it might be helpful. Yeah, it's under the contact page, what to do with unwanted furniture. And it basically lists, you can pass it on, you can donate it to charity, you can sell it online, you can go and do a car boot sale, you can upcycle it yourself. It lists places where you can take, charities that take furniture, charities that upcycle furniture, charities that sell furniture online. It's quite a nice little resource if you're in the UK. And even if you're not in the UK, it gives you ideas as to what you can do with it. So I follow a lady on Instagram, and she takes pictures of furniture that have been dumped on the side of the road. I was actually quite shocked at how much furniture is just left on the side of the road. So you don't have anywhere that you can take it?
I hate to say this. I think it's laziness.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think it is turning a blind eye to the state that our planet is in.
Out of sight, out of mind.
And saying, I am not going to see it, and sticking their head in the ground and saying, I'm not going to be responsible. Because yes, we do have consignment shops, we have secondhand stores, we have Facebook Marketplace, we have the Buy Nothing group, many avenues, I would say, and many opportunities, but it all takes effort to keep perfectly good stuff out of the landfill.
Like I could see, I know she's in a city, and I could see maybe if you don't have a car, it might be quite difficult to get it to the tip. But there are definitely charities, I know in the UK, who will pick up furniture for a small fee.
Yeah, there we have some here too.
Yeah.
So tell me specifically about a day at school. So you show up and like, is there a lecture? Is it a big room with workshop tabletops and tools? Tell me more.
We get there about 9:30 and everybody loads their chairs and all their tools in, and you each have your own little bench. And depending on where we are in the project, so at the moment we're doing traditional chairs, so stuffing and springs and that sort of stuff. So most people have slight differences in their chairs. But when we were doing our modern, which was a Parker Knoll prior to this one, we'd have demonstrations by the teacher, maybe half an hour or so, depending on what was next in the process. And then we spend 6 hours doing upholstering our chair, asking questions, learning cuts, learning different processes. On the traditional chairs that we're doing now, I'm doing something very different to what everyone else is doing. Everybody else is doing a Victorian spoonback chair. And I'm doing fluting, and they're going to be doing buttoning. Some of them might do a little bit of fluting, but not as much. So I'm really watching what they're doing and taking notes on what they're doing, as well as taking notes on what I'm doing as well. I'm supposed to be doing. So that's a typical day. You basically spend 6 hours upholstering, which is an amazing way to spend 6 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me about your kids and how they're viewing this journey.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know how they're viewing the journey.
Do they know what is happening now is bringing out a happier version of you?
So my husband and I have always been very we parent very similarly, and we have always told our children everything. We have never kept anything from them. And so I am quite proud to say that my children are emotionally quite mature. They maybe don't know all the exact details, but they know that I am on a spiritual journey of making myself better. They're both teenagers now. One's 15, one's 13. And they're having their own troubles, mental health. You know, COVID wasn't great for any child. I can't imagine any child who had a good time during COVID. You know, I'm talking about overall, not specific lovely days with the family out in the sunshine. So I think now they're more able to see. I'm always putting my hand up and going, I had a really bad morning and I was short and sharp. I will put my hand up and I'll go, I'm so sorry. I've just realized where this is coming from, and I'm on it. I'm working on the change, sort of thing.
Or I'm owning it.
I'm owning it. Definitely owning it. And so we do a lot of talking about how we can make changes. I love the quote from George Bernard Shaw. If you cannot change your mind, you cannot change anything. And it's kind of the quote that we use in our family. Listen, if you're struggling with something, how can we change your mind about it? You know, we can't change any other person. We cannot physically change another person, the way they're being or the way they're behaving or we can only change what we view, how we view or our perception of a certain situation. So there's a lot of that that happens in our household, and putting our hands up and saying sorry.
Are your kids leaning toward doing things with their hands?
My eldest is an incredible painter, drawer, crocheter. She's very into both of my girls are into pottery. My youngest does spray painting, so kind of like murals on the side of buildings. We obviously don't have paper quite that big or buildings for her to be, but she does nice big
large scale stuff
using mural spray paints. She does stuff like that. They both love their pottery. I think my youngest maybe isn't as confident as the eldest. There's a slight view of, well, I can't draw, so then I'm not creative. And that is like, I keep saying, please stop saying that, because there is so much more to creativity than just drawing. So yes, they definitely use their hands.
Boy, I would love... I was going to say, I would love to spend a week there. I can't even imagine between you and the girls how much goodness happens in the walls of your house.
Well, maybe you could come over and you could sit around our fire pit, because I think we both have an affinity with fire pits.
We do.
And that is, I don't know if you read it on my little bio there,
but I did.
It is my absolute favorite place to be in the world.
Tell me about your fire pit.
Oh, so it was made by a friend of mine who is a metal worker, and he buys these metal spheres and chops them in half, and then just drills a few holes in the bottom, and then puts whatever feet on that you want. So when you hit it with another piece of metal, it's like a gong, because it is a half sphere. And it makes the most beautiful noise.
Wow.
So you can literally be doing a bit of meditation, listening to a gong with the fire going outside. Yeah, it's lovely under the stars.
That's incredible. Tell me about your favorite fire pit food or drink or treat. Do you have a tradition?
Oh, a bit of homemade sloe gin.
Wonderful.
I don't drink anymore. On very rare occasions, I'll have some, but I still love a tiny little sherry glass full of homemade sloe gin by the fire.
Oh, I love that.
What's yours?
We actually, in COVID, we were trying to make s'mores, and because of the shortage of everything, there were no graham crackers. And so we substituted a molasses cookie for a graham cracker and came upon the most delightful version, and we never will go back. It's a marshmallow between two gooey molasses cookies. It is the most, we usually have to split it because, oh my gosh, a delight.
So because my daughter, I'm gluten-free, as is one of my children. So we have made s'mores using rice crackers. So they're not quite as sweet as, and definitely not sticky like molasses cookies, but they are just as nice.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Tell me about your house that you currently live in and the furniture in it.
I have a lot of my own painted furniture in my house, painted and palette furniture that I've made. We're about to do a loft conversion, so I'm now thinking about what furniture I'll be able to put up there, because we'll have a bit of a yoga space, chill out space, and two bedrooms. So I've got to think about where I'll get my bedside tables from, you know, chests of drawers that will fit up the loft stairs. So that's kind of in the back of my mind. So I have another excuse to go and check out the tip and the charity shops. And my husband's like, do not bring any more furniture into this house.
Tell me what it is now. You said it's a conversion. Tell me what it's going to, what's the before?
Oh, it's just the loft space that literally we have a, open the hatch and the ladder slides down and it's a dumping ground.
We call that an attic.
We have spent all day, most of yesterday and all day today, sorting out the outside shed so that, because everything has to come out of the loft, obviously, in the next, I'd say probably 4 to 6 months. So we've started bringing stuff down and just going through it and clearing out. It's been so cathartic all day, just clearing stuff out, taking stuff to the tip that, you know, putting it into the shop at the tip, recycling, lots of recycling. And yeah, it's been fantastic. I love a clear out.
The caveat there is that it's also a lot of work because you're not just putting it in a landfill. So it's very conscious. Who could use this? What organization might be able to use it? Contacting them, transporting it. It's a whole thing, which is why I think it's so important to ask the questions that you asked when you're buying. Yeah. Because if you're putting yourself in the same situation in the future by buying that thing, because then you're going to have to get rid of it. If you fast forward 15 years, that doesn't make any sense.
It does take more time. Yeah. And I think, like you said before, that's a lot of the reason why people will just dump it onto the street. People can't recognize the value of the item that they're dumping because it is just so easy to go out and buy another one, and often cheap, and often cheaper, especially if you're talking something like upholstery, although the cost of furniture has started going up and is now kind of in line with reupholstering a chair, depending on what fabric you choose, which is helpful for upholsters. I think I would love it if there was any way that if anybody came to my Instagram or my, and I might need to actually, now that I'm thinking about this, update my website to talk about the value of those things that we already have. And although they might not look valuable to us, to someone else, they might be very valuable. Please, please, taking that time to get it to that particular person or that particular company who will then find the person who has seized the value in it.
The next home. Yeah.
The next home. Yeah. The next journey of this piece of furniture's life.
Let's talk about the access to your space that you said now has a pull down ladder. Mm-hmm. Are you going to make that a proper stair?
Oh, no, it is going to be a proper staircase.
So in your floor plan, that's going to take a bit of square footage also to incorporate for a, you know, the rise required to get that stairs to go up. That's a whole lot of planning.
We have a pretty big house in terms of, it's a 1960s build, square, rectangular. To get the stairs and the rise is not going to be an issue. When we get up into the loft, I think we're going to have 1.8 meters.
Which is about 6 feet.
At the height, we're going to put a flat roof on it, as big a flat roof as we possibly can get, before it then is going to start to slope down.
So you're redoing your roof line also?
The entire roof is coming off. Yeah.
Holy buckets.
Yeah, the entire roof is coming off. We're going to have what they call a tent on top of the house for probably 4 months.
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty major. We're recutting the entire roof.
Please, I shouldn't say, are you going to? Can you please document some of this in your Instagram stories?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You'll be so sick of it by the time, you'll be as sick of it as I will be by the time.
I don't know about that. If you're are you living there through the entire thing?
Well, yes. Although when we were speaking to the architect yesterday, we just kind of finalized exactly how we want it to look. And he went, so, you know, have you thought about where you're going to be moving out? I was like, I was going to live here. He's like, it'll take more time and it'll take longer if we're having to turn on the electricity every night for you and turn on the water every night for you and all that stuff. And I went, oh, I thought we could kind of do it room by room. He's like, no, it'll be a lot quicker just to take the entire roof of your house off. I was like, okay, then. So we're now looking at fifth wheel trailers.
Oh, it's going to be an adventure.
Just park it in the front garden it will be good fun. Not sure my children will like it quite as much as I will, but it will be an experience for them.
Hilarious. I can't even wait.
Yeah.
Well, you have a fabulous Instagram page, and I want to be sure to share that in the show notes also for everyone who wants to follow along on your journey. We'll be looking out for that chair that you're going to make next year. If you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to the show so new episodes are automatically queued up for you. It's one less thing you need to go search for, reducing your mental load. Also, if you'd like more of this kind of content, you can subscribe to Little Bits, my weekly newsletter about home functionality, always with a short video and a thought for you to think through about your space and your reason. Expect short but close inspections of home details. And as usual, I always pose questions for you to think through. Find the link in the show notes. Earlier, Courtney mentioned our mutual love for fire pits. There are few things in life as nostalgic as sitting around an open fire on a crisp, starry night, sharing stories, watching the smoke rise, passing a ukulele around or a guitar, listening to the crackle of the wood ablaze. If you've considered adding one to your yard, let's deep dive into size, aesthetic, functionality, and portability with special guest Mike Bertelson of the Cowboy Cauldron Company. No matter if you own a tiny home or a luxurious resort, there's a fire pit with your name on it. Listen to episode 38 of the Home Space and Reason podcast, available anywhere you listen and linked in the show notes. If you happen to know someone in the market to buy or sell in the Portland, Oregon metro area, kindly send them my way. The finest compliment I can receive is the confidence of your referral. Thanks for joining me today. Here's to old friends and new. We're more alike than we are different. I'll meet you back here for the next episode. Cheers.